Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, in the studios of WMOT-FM. The Writer's Loft is MTSU's non-residency certificate in creative writing program. You can work one-on-one with a faculty mentor of your choosing, hone your writing skills as you produce a publishable manuscript. You can earn a certificate in creative writing. And the big cheese of the Writer's Loft, the director, is a guy who's been on this program many times before. He's familiar to listeners of this program, talking about other things like religion and philosophy. He's Dr. Rami Shapiro. He's an adjunct professor of religious studies at MTSU in the Department of Philosophy. He's also an ordained rabbi and an award-winning author of several books, more than 20, as a matter of fact, and his very own blog, which can be found at rabbirami.blogspot.com. Does that take in everything about you?
That covers everything except that I'm the director of the Writer's Loft.
I said that.
Oh, okay. I missed it.
I said you were the big cheese.
I must have dozed. Oh, the big cheese. Okay. I thought maybe I dozed off or something.
Well, I have that effect on people.
No,
you should have known that by
now. Not on me.
I went to a recent orientation for the Writer's Loft, a two-day affair. Didn't attend the entire thing. Attended most of it, I'd say about two-thirds of it. And I came away with a whole bunch of handouts. You provide a great deal of literature and a wealth of information for folks. Tell us something about the kind of folks who are attracted to this program. We went around the table and met a lot of different interesting folks who are either interested in writing or are already published writers and want to get better.
Yeah, it's an interesting mix of people that go to the Writer's Loft. Let me just preface it by saying that the Writer's Loft is not an MFA.
No.
And people who are looking for an MFA are not going to be attracted to the Writer's Loft. Our approach is we're manuscript driven. You're not going to learn a lot about literature in this program. You're going to, by working with a mentor one-on-one, you're going to be honing the skills you have and improving them and producing a manuscript. So people who come to us aren't looking for a degree, they're looking for a product. And while we don't require people to complete a publishable manuscript within 12 months, the university will award a certificate in creative writing if you go through 12 months of the program. We divide the program into 4 3-month segments. You can take them sequentially or take 3 months, take 6 months off and come back. But when you've put in 12 months, the university will graduate you with a certificate in creative writing. Our approach on a more concrete level is we think that we can get you from idea to publishable manuscript in 12 months, whether it's a novel or
poems, short stories.
Because we're part of the English department, we have access to the entire English faculty, and then we have a faculty from outside the university that are also part of the Loft, because it's a mentor program, so you can work, you're working basically through email, so you can work with a mentor anywhere in the country, and we try to find the right person for you, given the genre you want to work in, and hope that within that one-year period, we'll have you ready to be published. Now, we don't guarantee publication. We're not a publisher.
Nobody can guarantee.
Right, exactly. But this will be something that you can take to an agent, you can take to a publisher, you can publish on yourself, certainly.
You even had Bob Pondillo there talking about the art of screenwriting there.
Right, Dr. Pondillo from MassCom. We had him as our keynote speaker on Friday night, and he showed one of his movies, Charlie Wu.
And the new true Charlie Wu.
Right, the new true Charlie Wu, and talked about screenwriting and how you do that and how you think for the screen. And it's a different kind of writing than most of the people who are doing in the program at the moment. But if someone's interested in screenwriting, he's actually our screenwriting faculty.
Now, you're helping folks get or obtain a marketable product. Where does the intersection of art and commerce come into play here? Because some folks are interested. They don't want to lose the craft along the way towards putting themselves out into a mass medium where they can be hopefully sampled by a great many people. They don't want to hone their work so that it serves the audience more so than it does their own voice, their own muse, their own inner spirit.
You don't want to lose yourself in order to get an audience.
Right.
That may not be that hard to do. You just got to figure out, I mean, put a vampire and a diet in anything and you'll probably sell.
Yeah, how to this or how to that.
Yeah, so there's lots of ways of just writing for an audience and you don't care who you are or what you have to say. But I don't think that's what we're finding in the Writer's Loft. I think the people there are either seeking their voice as a writer or have it and are trying to make it more, give it some more clarity. But, you know, I write for a living, you know, so like, you know, Shakespeare and I wrote for the money. So I have a voice. I have an opinion. I have a way of a style that's my own. And yet I do have to shape it to the marketplace. And that's where the editor comes in, really. I write what I think is the best thing I can do, send it off to my publisher, and then they come back and say, that may be the most clear you can be with the voice you have, but the market is going to demand something different. We have to massage it. And that's the game. If you're going to try to get published by a commercial press, then that's the game you have to play.
Well, you write differently for different media as well. You don't write the same way for your blog, for example, that you would if you were writing a scholarly tome that was meant to be used in the college classroom.
Right, exactly. So you have to know your audience in that sense.
Every writer goes through a different mental and emotional process. Describe yours. What is your process as you sit down to write?
So I start out thinking that I can do, you know, whatever it is I have to do, whatever the project is, whether it's a, you know, an article for a magazine, which I do on a regular basis, whether it's a chapter in a book or a full-length book of my own, I always figure I can sit down and knock it off in about 3 to 4 minutes. That's what I think when I start. All the ideas are crystal clear.
You think a lot of yourself, don't you?
I really do, right? The ideas are crystal clear in my mind. I know exactly what I want to say. I know exactly how I want to say it. And then I sit down and it goes away. And I go, uh-oh, that's not going to work.
You mean the thought goes totally out of your head, or you sit down and write a bunch of crap?
Well, I don't mind writing a bunch of crap. It's that the original idea turns out, from the moment I start to go, that isn't even going to begin to make, to fly. So everything I thought I had that was going to work, I just let it go. It's and then I just start from scratch. And writing, let me be very clear, I love to write, and it's absolutely an agonizing process, because it's never good enough, it's never clear enough, it's never right enough, and then I get lost in what I'm saying, and I get confused by what I'm saying, and I have to rewrite and reread over and over and over again. It's very much a process of just dumping stuff on a page and then carving away all the crap and to see if there's anything of value in there. I just finished a manuscript last night, up against deadline. It's part of a series that I was hired to write, and I wrote 4 drafts before I even had one that was partially that even made partial sense.
Do you edit as you go, or do you write the whole schmear and then go back and edit?
I write till I've sort of run out of stuff, and then when I go back to start again, I oftentimes start from the beginning and just read what I wrote, and then I discover it's just nonsense. I mean, this book I rewrote from scratch 4 times, and then yesterday I finally took the 5th draft, and it seems to make sense. Now, I haven't read it since yesterday, and I won't read it for a few days to sort of let it settle, and then I go back, and I'm hoping I'll find enough to work with to go for another draft and make my deadline.
But the great thing about writing is that Rami's process doesn't have to be your process. You can be true to your own comfort zone. And
oh,
still
absolutely.
Come out with something that is both readable and marketable.
Yeah, there's no right way to do this. It's just your way to do it. So that's just mine. It's just write and rewrite and throw away, and I get very frustrated. And you know, and so it's not a pleasurable experience, and I'm not a very pleasing person when I'm in the midst of it, but there's nothing I want to do more. It's just something addictive about it, about just sitting there in front of a blank screen and eventually having, whether it's an article or a book, having put that together in a way that makes a point, in a way that's hopefully compelling and appealing.
And he does it without alcohol or drugs.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you read a lot of writers, they're alcoholics or drug addicts. And no, I overeat, but that's so I'll eat my way through a book, but I won't drink my way through.
Tell us about the test that you had folks fill out at the orientation, the 70-question survey that is designed to help them, by tabulating the numbers at the conclusion of it, find what kind of a writer they are.
Yeah, what I did was I gave, as part of our orientation weekend, and we don't always do this. This is actually the first time I think we've done it, is I used the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator, which is a classic personality assessment tool. And a lot of businesses use it for different things. I used it specifically to help people understand how their thought processes might work. I mean, I never want to reduce a person to a test. But it does seem to have enough accuracy to give us something to talk about. And so it looks at, I won't go into the whole long thing, but it gives us some insight into how you're going to structure your work and how you best, how you ought to even structure your office, your work, your writing space. Do you want to be in a place that's busy and noisy? Do you need a place that's quiet? Do you need to take your material to a writer's group right away and get input from the outside? Or do you need to really stay by yourself and just use input from the inside? So it was an interesting tool to help people think about their writing process and work with their strengths. We're not trying to make you a more well-rounded writer. We're trying to simply take you where you're strong and make you stronger.
Not to put a label on you or caricature you, but perhaps even just to give you some insight about yourself that you didn't even realize.
Yeah, right. That was the goal.
And I turned out to be, my four letters were INFJ, which stand for
introverted,
intuitive, feeling, and judging.
Right. So,
which means
I'm not going to analyze you on the air, though.
Well, that's a good thing. Well, you don't want to get sued, right?
Oh, okay.
Now, I need a lot of noise because I'm accustomed to working in newsrooms. I'm accustomed to having seven police scanners around me, a tape machine whirring, and noise coming off of the radio station I'm working for, noise coming off of the television. I can't function without noise. I can't write in a quiet room. It's just antithetical to me. I can't even. And yet I'll concentrate totally on what I'm doing, you know, phrases that go off on the television or radio or whatever I'm listening to, internet radio, are not going to end up in my writing because there's a sort of a firewall there.
That's it, the firewall. And the I in the first of your four letters, even though we're not going to go through the whole thing,
right.
The I is introvert. An introvert can work in a very noisy environment because they have the capacity to shut out everything on the outside and just focus on what they're doing and really listening to the inner voice and not the outer noise. The opposite type, the extroverted type, the E in the Myers-Briggs, is someone who is really drawn to all the outer noise. So if you need to focus on a project and you're an E, the last thing you want to do is be in a noisy place because you'll be listening to everyone else's conversations and you'll be distracted by the music and everything captures your attention except the writing. Whereas if you're an I, you can be in that very same noisy environment and just block it all out. So once you know that about yourself, then you can look to structure your environment to be as conducive as possible to getting as much done as possible.
If you're already a published author, and I saw at least one young lady there, well, at least two people there, who had already had some of their works published. One was a poet and had works of her poetry on the table. Why would you go to a place like the Writer's Loft? Would you not feel that you are accomplished enough or not feel that you've reached a wide enough audience? Why would you go to a place like the Writer's Loft if you've already published?
Well, I think those two reasons are good ones, right? You might want a wider audience, and maybe there's something that we can help you, we can help with your writing in such a way that it gives you a wider audience. But I think most of the people, even those who are published, are attracted to the fact that you're working one-on-one with a mentor who's just going to keep you writing. You know, most of the people, not everyone at Writer's Loft, but most of the people at Writer's Loft don't write for a living. You know, I get up in the morning, I mean, I teach class here at MTSU, and I teach some classes at Scarrett Bennett Center in Nashville, but mostly my job is writing. And most people don't have that I would say, luxury of getting up in the morning and just sitting down at your desk and starting to write. So you have to carve out time, and it helps to have someone who's looking over your shoulder saying, don't forget, you got to get this done. There are deadlines. The university has set this timetable you have to meet. So I think some people want that. And we had one woman in the loft this semester. We have one woman in the loft this semester who has a contract. And she's published, and she's got something else coming out, and there's a deadline, there's a contract, and she just can't structure her life in such a way as to make it happen. So she's basically hired a professor from the university to sit with her, you know, not physically, but you know, right, through the internet, to sit with her and say, okay, we got to get this chapter done by Friday, and you got to have it to me on the email so I can get it back to you in a week, and just keep cranking it out. In order to meet her deadline. So I think a lot of it is that people enjoy having someone who's devoted to their writing besides themselves.
Who are your mentors? What kind of people would volunteer their time to mentor budding writers?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to know that they're almost volunteering their time. I mean, the university does pay mentors, but very, very little. So you're doing this more or less as an act of love.
Right.
So the mentors that I know in the program, the people I've talked to, are people who are so passionate about writing that they just want to see somebody else get the same enthusiasm out of it, the same joy out of it than they get. I mean, that's why I'm doing it. I have one, as the director, I try not to take on students, but we had one gentleman come in from Texas specifically because he read one of my books and wanted to work with me, so I agreed. And, you know, I'm doing it just because, A, it's exciting to watch him go through the process of discovering he's a writer. Mm-hmm. And, B, his stuff is good. I mean, I'm going to learn something myself, content-wise. And he's a quirky character. And the book is going to be really a lot of fun to watch emerge. So I'm going to get out a lot. I'm going to get a lot out of this, too. But what drives me is, can I help someone else find the joy in writing that I do, along with banging my head against the wall when I'm doing it? I still wouldn't want to do anything else.
You had some publishers at the orientation talk about how they run their particular operations, and there were different business models for each of the four individuals who offered their words of wisdom. I went to the Southern Festival of Books one year in Nashville, and there were tents pitched out in the plaza, and a great many of the people under those tents were offering you deals like, you put down 50% and then we'll pay 50% of the costs. And I felt, I'm not getting into this, but there are a lot more varieties of self-publication out there than you might think, not just your standard operational rip-off, which is what that sounded like to me. Somewhere between the rip-off and Random House, there have to be a lot of different ways to get your work out there.
Yeah, well, that's true. I started publishing with Random House, and I've been with Harper San Francisco when they were still around. They're gone. I've been with lots of different publishers over the decades I've been doing this. And we're at a time when there's a lot of options to the mainstream New York-based commercial press. So we had four people at the Writer's Loft this time. Specifically, I invited these four people because they had different business models. One of them was just self-publishing. He only did his own stuff. He worked with a very narrow... his area was a certain kind of Turkish Islamic studies, and there were, you know, maybe 100 people in the world who were interested in the in-depth scholarship he was doing. No commercial press was going to pick that up.
It's the definition of a niche audience.
Right, a real niche audience. And he loves it because he gets to teach what he knows best to the experts like himself who want that.
And great for him.
Exactly. And there was, a professor from MTSU, retired Ron Messier, with his new company called Twin Oaks, which is a cooperative press, where it's sort of a band of... fellow writers who just band together, and you do pay. I mean, you have to pay to have your work edited and all this. But he will ultimately publish it, but not for profit. I think he said he gets $1 a book, and the rest of the money goes to the author.
It's a true labor of love for them.
It really was. And then there were people in between. The point is, there's lots of models out there. When I started, there were two models. There was commercial press, which meant you really had to break into some big house in New York, which I know how I did it, but it was a fluke. And there was vanity press. Vanity press is when someone says, if you pay all the money, I'll go ahead and print your book and give you 1,000 copies to stick in your basement, and good luck if you have a basement, your garage, your bedroom, and then you sell them. And they're really just printing houses. They don't edit. They don't design. They just put out whatever you give them.
And they don't promote.
Yes. So they're very, very, they're not the way to go. But vanity press is very different than self-publishing and some of these other smaller presses where, the publisher in a commercial press, the publisher takes all the risk and makes most of the money, along with the bookstore, but the author makes the least. Then there's these other ways of doing it where you share the risk. So I'm in a situation now where I've been offered this, I've accepted the contract for a series of books, and they told me that what they're doing is a risk. It's a risk for them. There's no known audience for this. They want to see if it'll work. So they don't want to take a risk of paying me up front. They'll take the risk of the cost of publication and marketing and all of that. They're not asking any money from me, but they're not going to offer me any money. I write the book because that's sweat equity. I'm putting that into it. They're going to publish it. They'll get it into Barnes & Noble, wherever else they get it. And then we'll split the profits 50-50. So I'm willing to try that. All my other books, I get in advance, and then hopefully royalties come in. But there's not a lot of money in it any way you do it. But we're at a point where people are trying a variety of business models. And
the reason there are all these cracks in the dike is because the market has changed, and the big publishing houses basically don't know what to do with themselves these days.
Right. I don't know exactly what's going on in major publishing houses, but I do know that the publishing world is really undergoing a major shift.
They get tons of manuscripts that just end up on a junk pile somewhere.
Right. Well, everyone is sending the manuscripts, and you look, or to an agent. Everyone's sending agents unsolicited manuscripts, hoping someone's going to notice something. The way I started was I self-published. My first book was a self-published book. I created my own company. I hired friends who were designers, and we made, a beautiful paperback book, a translation of a 2,000-year-old rabbinic text. And I translated it into modern English, so I thought it was relevant again. And it sold a little, I don't know how well, but it sold. I was making a few at a time, and they were just going. And I was happy. That's all I really cared about. Somehow, a copy was shared with an editor in New York from Random House, and she read it and loved it and called me up and said, if I own the rights, she'd like to buy them from me and publish it at Random House. And once you get one book, then they did a second, then they did a third. So I happened to slip into that because someone saw my self-published work. So there's a lot of reasons to self-publish. Not only that, you can actually be a successful publisher just doing that. Chicken Soup of the Soul, that's how they did it. And they made millions and millions of dollars. It's an empire of chicken soup books. So, it used to be either I have them stacked up in my garage or I'm at the mercy of some giant publisher that is never going to notice me anyway. Now you can really take control of that, of your own publishing destiny, and put stuff out there. Even if you don't want to expend the cost of printing, which is a major expense, you can publish digitally, through ebooks. There's lots of interesting stuff going on, a lot of experimental stuff going on in ebooks, because I may not take a chance on someone doing something odd if it's going to cost me $18. But if it's costing me $5.99 or $2.99 on Amazon, someone's doing it in the Kindle department or the Nook or, for Barnes & Noble. But if there's an ebook out there and it's not going to break the bank in any way, and I can do it as an impulse thing just because I'm curious, they sell. And if
Why
it's
not?
Good, they'll sell more. So it's a very exciting time to be a writer.
You also had an expert there, or a consultant who specializes in social media, Facebook, Twitter, right. Blogs. How does someone who is attempting to hone their writing skills use these new technological innovations?
Well, let me suggest that you don't become a better writer just by writing more. Because if you've got flaws in your writing and you just keep writing, you'll just keep writing the same flaws.
Old stuff.
So it's not that you can just, well, I'm just going to blog and it'll be great or I'll get better at it over time. You really need a teacher. That's where the mentor comes in. Someone who can say, and it doesn't have to be a Writer's Loft person, though certainly I'd love to have people sign up, but it can be a writing group. It can be, you know, your peers who are reading your stuff and saying, this doesn't work and that doesn't work. You need to bounce the work off of someone who you trust, who has the courage to say when it doesn't work. And that helps you improve your writing. So improving your writing is a separate thing. But once you're trying to build an audience, the internet is absolutely essential. Every writer needs a blog. Every writer needs to be on Twitter. Every writer needs to be on Facebook, maybe LinkedIn also if you're looking for work as a writer. There's so many things that you have to do. I spend too much time on the social media stuff. I'd rather be doing something else, but I realize it's important.
But your blog is chock full of terrifically enlightening satirical snippets, and it's highly topical.
Right. I mean, this is the way I do it. I was just speaking in general, but if you want to talk about how I do it, I have different facets to my personality. So the books that I publish are they're not humor. I mean, they're serious books. I translate Bible. I do commentaries, you know, stuff like that. It's serious work. But I'm not a serious person. I can just do serious work when I need to. I like being funny. I have a skewed way of looking at things. And I need an outlet for that. So my blog is the outlet for that. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody who would pay me to write humor. But the blog is free. And I have a lot of people who read the blog. And then there's a side of me that's really snarky, that I just listen to proverbs of New Age gurus and they make me gag. And I try to rewrite them so that you can see how stupid they are.
I've been gagging ever since Werner Erhard came out with Est. But yeah,
exactly. So I read these New Agey things and then I skewer them. And that's my Twitter persona. So, but I do that just for my own, just for fun.
I can see how Facebook and Twitter could help you promote your material.
And
I can't.
It does that.
I right. cannot see how writing tweets can help you become a better writer.
Well, now let me challenge that a little bit. I actually teach a course both at the Writer's Loft and with my other writing program called Path and Pen in Nashville at Scarrett Bennett Center. I teach a class I call it Writing for Twitter. It's a class in writing aphorisms. So you take that 140 character form, and it's actually a little bit less because you want to be able to have it, you know, retweeted. So you have, but at the outside, you have 140 characters, including spaces. Can you say something meaningful in that space? And that's a real challenge. That's sort of the haiku mentality.
But if you're talking about aphorisms, yeah. I mean, you've got, this is Tuesdays for Maury on the internet, you know, is basically what that is. Yeah, but I'm talking about putting together a more long-form cogent thought. So many people who get
on Twitter
and get on Facebook write, and people who post comments on newspapers that are online, the DNJ and the Tennessee, and especially on some of the more controversial stories, the grammar is atrocious.
Yeah, well,
you can't make out what they're saying. It's just a jumbled mess.
Right. I mean, if you say, what's a writer is a person who writes. Not every person who writes is a writer, but every writer has to write. So, yeah, you get a lot of junk out there, and the internet is a huge catch-all for anything people want to scribble down.
That's the side effect of it being such an egalitarian venue.
So many people can have access to it and can see themselves as a journalist or a writer or whatever it is.
Right. You get Carrot Top and Lenny Bruce in the same place.
Yeah, right.
It's bizarre.
Well, you know, that's just the nature of the beast. I still think the cream will rise to the top and the good stuff will come out of that. But you mentioned promotion, and that's crucial. I mean, if you're trying to get a book published by a commercial press, and you can say, I have 1,000 Facebook friends, and I have 2,000 Twitter followers, then right away the marketer, the publisher thinks, well, right away, there's 3,000 people you can touch who know you, who have given you permission to bug them about whatever you're interested in. So you're interested in your book, so send them, you know, an announcement that it's coming out and say, hey, I'm giving away a free chapter. And, you know, there's lots of ways to use that for marketing.
It's at least a potential audience.
Oh, right. You don't know. Right. But these are already people, like if you know, you can't be my friend unless you decide to ask to be my friend on Facebook.
Right.
So you've already made the effort. It's called permission marketing. You've given me permission to tell you stuff by saying I want to follow you on Twitter.
We have exchanged business cards in cyberspace.
Right. So you want to hear from me? So here I'm telling you that I just finished my new book. It comes out, you know, it's on Amazon today or whatever it is.
Tell your friends.
Exactly. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I'm proud of what I write. I stand behind what I write. Mm-hmm. And I want people to read it. Otherwise, I didn't have to go to all that agony. I could have just thought the thoughts and impressed myself. I didn't have to go to all the pain of actually writing it and polishing it and getting it published. So I want people to read it. And, those are great venues for getting that information out there.
In the movie Shadowlands, Anthony Hopkins portraying C.S. Lewis said, "We read to know we're not alone." Do we write to know we're not alone, too?
That's interesting. Certainly it's clear to me that I read to know I'm not alone. I would say, I'm not exactly sure how to respond to that. I sort of think that my writing is, you're shouting out into the void to see if there's anybody out there. And if someone emails you back and says, I loved your book, it changed my life, or I hate your book, even that changes their life, right? If someone's read it, whether they like it or they don't like it, though I prefer positive feedback to negative, if someone's out there and they've read it, yeah, it makes you feel like you're not alone. I've touched somebody in this way.
They were interested enough to at least sample your wares.
Right.
To sample your creativity.
Right. But I do hear from a lot of people who read my stuff, and I have a lot of books out there. So I do get email from people who have questions sometimes, but sometimes it's just a pat on the back. You know, I read this. I really liked it. It made me think about reading some more of some other, you know, in some other field that I hadn't been interested in before. I read your intro to it. So it just feels good to know that someone else was touched by what you think is important.
If someone wants to know more about the Writer's Loft, what do they need to do?
Well, we have our Writer's Loft page on MTSU's website. You just go to www.mtsu.edu/theloft, and that will get you there. And if that's too hard, you can actually, if you want to type the whole thing out, you can go to www.thewritersloft@mtsu.com, and that will take you to the MTSU website too. But it's basically mtsu.edu/theloft.
Dr. Rami Shapiro, who is the director of the Writer's Loft, as well as the Big Cheese. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
Same here. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Please join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com. And we're available on iTunes.